It's time for Meaningful Insights, every researcher's delight. It's data night.
Hello, and welcome to our second episode of Data Night. My name is Kasia Ely, and I'll be your host. And with me today is Kyle Chan, a second year PhD student at UNC in the Political Science Department, with a specialization in comparative politics, and also one of our graduate student consultants at the Statistics Help Desk in Davis Library. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Kasia. How are you?
I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for joining us today.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
Very excited to talk about your project.
Yeah, so. Sure. The results just came in like yesterday, so refresh still.
Perfect timing.
Yeah.
All right. So before we get to that, can you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so I'm a second year student at the Political Science Department. I joined 2018. I study mostly European politics, especially what we call multi-level governance. So what that is that it's basically the interaction of the national government and the regional government, but it could also go beyond governance issues. It could also be like political issues. So the stuff that I'm doing right now is about party competition, like political parties, their positions, their electoral strategy at the regional level. So that's like the top pickup of my expertise. In terms of regions, mostly Western Europe, but sometimes I do stuff in Asia as well. I mean, I'm from Hong Kong, so I know the region. So yeah, that's pretty much what I do. And also in terms of methods, getting more computational nowadays. This project is about text mining. So more and more computational, yeah.
Real quick for our listeners who might not know, what is text mining?
Text mining, or just text analysis in general, is that you try to derive high quality information from text. So imagine you have like a library of like 10,000 papers. You don't want to read 10,000 papers. So instead of doing that yourself, you develop an algorithm, or you use existing algorithms to get information from those 10,000 documents. So one way that people do is that they try to find topics in these documents. So say I believe there are 20 topics in these documents. Then you sort of break down the text into words, and then you use some algorithm to figure out like whether the words will cluster. And if the clusters are there and if they're coherent, then you have a topic, and then you realize what those topics are after doing some more analysis. So that's the general idea, yeah. It's becoming more and more popular, not only in the social sciences, but also in humanities. So I know that people use this stuff to analyze the Bible, analyze like literary works. So it's more common than you think nowadays, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how you're using that in the current project?
Right, so right now, the project that I'm doing, I'm trying to figure out what parties stand on issues. The problem is that, well, we actually have a lot of existing data sets for parties at the national level. Problem is that there is very little at the regional level, which is the level that I'm interested in. Certainly not for smaller parties or regionalist parties, the kind of parties I focus about, you know, the parties that talk about defending regional interests, defending regional identity, those parties. A lot of the times experts, when they look at them, right, they only look at like the biggest party. So for example, in Scotland, right, you have the Scottish National Party. You can always find data for that. But what about the smaller parties? Like there is the Scottish Greens, which is surprisingly also very regionalist, very pro-independence. You just don't have much data on that party because, well, first of all, they're new. And second of all, they're way smaller than the SNP. Same thing in Catalonia, you have the Convergence and Union, and later now called it Together for Yes, or Together for Catalonia, they changed their names several times. It's the same thing. Big party, a lot of data. what about the smaller ones? So say the Republican Workers for the Left, the ERC. Some data sets have them, some don't. So it's just very annoying when your data set has a lot of holes, a lot of NAs. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to use the legislative proceedings, the records of what these MPs spoke in parliament to figure out where they stand. So the text analysis part come in terms of figuring out what they're saying in the parliament. So you remember I was saying, well, let's say there are 20 topics and figure out what the topics are. I'm doing the same thing. So I have, say, 8,000 legislative records throughout like the year throughout the history of the entire regional parliament. And I want to figure out what they talk about for all these years. Then you do that, and then you can figure out the topics, right? So for example, there's a topic about the economy, there's a topic about immigration. That's good. The next thing is to figure out the likelihood of, say, a given party in a given year of talking about, say, immigration. Mm-hmm. Once you have that, there you go, that's the data. You can sort of estimate where they stand on these issues. Do they talk about this thing very often, like positively too, or negatively? You can do one more layer of that. So right now, before doing the text analysis stuff, I also do sentiment analysis to figure out whether the document is positive or negative. Combine that, you have something called like a positive issue salience, negative issue salience. So do you talk a lot of positive things about, say, immigration? Mm-hmm. Or do you talk a lot about negative things about immigration? Because you can do both, right? So, mm-hmm. for example, I can say, well, immigration has both its upsides and its downsides. Mm-hmm. And there you go, you have the positive and the negative salience. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's what I've been doing, and that's how text analysis comes into play.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about what you think the value is of studying these smaller, newer groups instead of just going with the national, average?
Yes. The thing is, like, it's fine for a long time in political science that you focus only on the national level, but increasingly in Europe and elsewhere, the national governments or the national parliaments, they don't govern alone. There is also the regional level. And for a lot of things to happen, like, you also need to cooperate or work with the regional parliaments. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the party system, you know, like the different composition of political parties, you know, how the relative strength and how many parties in a given election, mm-hmm. they are completely different at the regional level. So the Scotland case, for example, the SNP, yes, they do have certain certain seats in Westminster, but Scottish Greens, not so much. Mm-hmm. They're simply not represented in Westminster. But if you go down to Holyrood, if you go down one level to the regional parliament, they're there. So if you just decide to ignore on all these parties, you're not getting the real picture of political competition, mm-hmm. because there are players below the national level too. And a lot of times, these parties, they think that the regional parliament or a regional political career is their terminal point. Like, that's the best thing that's the best thing for me as a politician. We tend to think that these people, you know, they start off small and they move up. That's no longer true. Yeah, a lot of studies now show that, for example, in Scotland, in Catalonia, in other regions, the regional MPs, they are happy for being a regional MP. They think that's the best career choice. You don't have to move up or move down. That's it. So if you ignore all that, you're missing on a huge group of politicians or political elites that have different objectives, say, the national level MPs, the national level members of parliament. That's what MP is. I should have defined that early. Anyway.
Interesting. I'm curious, what made you focus on Europe specifically?
Okay. Well, it's interesting because in Europe, you have a lot, they have a lot more diverse party systems, different kinds of parties. Here in the US, we only have two. That's it. End of story. You may have a little bit of variation in different states, but that's it. It's not that interesting for a Wearian standpoint. Mm. but in Europe, it's just way more diverse and going from one country to another, mm-hmm. the landscape is completely different. So say you move from Italy to France. France is notorious for not having very strong regional governments. Then you have way less representation for the regionalist parties. So that diversity could allow you to do a lot of things in terms of theory, right? You can test out a lot of things like, oh, is it that the regional authority makes these party more likely to talk about certain issues, or is it the regional authority that makes them more represented in the regional level? So that allows you to do that. That's the data standpoint. But the substantive standpoint for me is that I was trying to connect the situation there in Western Europe to Hong Kong. The way I do this is that in Hong Kong, a lot of the political problems are actually originating from the contentious relationship with China, which is the national level government. Of course, it's not a democracy, but if you think it like that, there is actually the commonality. Being, say, comparing Hong Kong-China relations to, say, Catalonia-Spain relations. So I see that in a lot of these European countries, you do have nationalism like Hong Kong does, or like other parts, other nationalist movement in the world. But in Europe, they do it in a way that they give you a parliament, they give you a unique identity, they recognize that, and then democracy still functions. It's not going to break up the state, right? So Catalonia, although it's getting more and more controversial, but it still works. So then the point of interest is to figure out, is this possible at all outside of Europe, right? Because you're trying to find general theories. So that's the substantive standpoint. So both in terms of data and in terms of substance, I just find it a very interesting case to study how you could go about managing subnational nationalism. Yeah.
Interesting. I'm curious, what would your end goal with your research be? What this particular project, what is the best case scenario? Who do you want to see it?
So this paper could easily be a measurement paper. I was actually talking to a methodologist in our department. And we were saying, well, if you couldn't find any substantive results, just turn it into a measurement paper. I mean, the first stage, you know, using documents to figure out party positions, that's a measurement issue. And it's not very common. I've seen this stuff being done in the European Parliament, but that's like the only paper that I know of. Yeah, there is another paper about comparing constitution, but constitution is different from, say, legislative records. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a very new approach of finding party positions. So that alone could be a whole different project on its own. Mm-hmm. And I was actually thinking about this. Maybe once I have data across Europe, the next intuitive step is actually to come back and sort of estimate the positions of the two parties that we have here in different states. Because there's an interesting thing about these parties having different positions across states. So I know that the Republicans in New York, you probably don't really want to talk about abortion, for example, because the population just don't want. they're not that pro-life, so to say. Mm. So comparing, say, the Republicans in New York to, say, here in North Carolina, then you probably have a difference. So that would be the next intuitive step. And then once you have a data set like that, you can sort of compare different parties, their position, and also not just different parties, but different parts of the party, because the US case would be the different parts of the party, mm-hmm. because they are pretty autonomous at the state level compared to say the UK parties, which is pretty centralized. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, it could go in a lot of different directions, but I can see this thing becoming a data set that people could use, which is great. Yeah, so I will start off looking only at regionalist parties, and once I've done that, maybe regional political parties, so not only the regionalist parties, but also other parties at the regional level. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then once that's done, we're going to come back to the US and use the same thing on the two parties that we have here. And of course, you will always get ambitious and you probably want to go beyond the Western hemisphere. You want to go to, say, some of the newer democracies like in East Asia or in Latin America. But that's, we're talking about 20 years worth of work to be done. So that's a long, long time. Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting. It seems like something, at least in the US version, that politicians would find very interesting, especially in larger races. Would you mind telling me exactly what a measurement paper is?
The measurement paper would be something like, well, we have something to measure. So in my case, party position, but it could also be other things like democracy, very vague concept, a lot of moving parts. Then you would say, well, it means certain things. So for example, for me, it could mean that, well, how likely are they to bring up the positive aspect of a topic? How likely they are going to bring up a negative aspect of the topic? In the case of democracy, well, you can say maybe it's about protection of minorities on top of having free and open elections. A level playing field for all different politicians. Mm-hmm. So not only the government party, but also the opposition could have an equal chance of winning office. So now you have all those parts. Mm-hmm. Then you sort of build a measurement. So you can quantify it, you can make it into, so what we recommend, like people use factor analysis, where you have loadings and then you compute an index. So that's the old way. The new way here that I'm doing is to use the text analysis. Okay, you have that, you have your measurement, that's good. But we don't know if this is actually capturing the reality, which is always the problematic part. So a lot of times a measurement paper would compare your estimation, your index, or your measurement with other similar measurements. Mm-hmm. And obviously you want these to positively correlate, mm-hmm. and not only giving you a small correlation, but it should have a high correlation so that it means that, well, I'm not deviating too much from the literature. Yeah, otherwise if you say you have a negative correlation, then it's just weird. Like, what are you measuring, right? Like, yeah, so you want to have a positive correlation high, but also not too high, because if it's like almost at one, that means you are not adding any value. So a proper measurement, you would see something like, well, my measure correlates positively with another existing measure, maybe at around 0.7, 0.8. That's good because it's not completely the same thing. Yeah, you are looking at different aspects of the same thing, but they're around, you are in the right direction, so to say. You use that, and then one extra step people usually do is to use your own estimate to predict something and to compare performance. Mm. Yeah, so for example, if going back to the case of democracy, you want to explain like democratization or just explain the quality of democracy in general, then you can use your own measure and use the measure that already exists and see if it would yield the same thing. If the effects are all the same, then you're good. It's in the right direction. If it's not the same direction, then you have some explanation to do. Mm-hmm. But once you've done all that, there's a measurement paper. They're usually shorter, and they're usually for the purpose of introducing a data set. Mm-hmm. So I sent you a paper earlier. That's exactly what a measurement paper would look like. So I have a new measure. That's how I collect the data, how my measure compares to other measures. And here's the result. It's positively correlated with other stuff. I'm in the right direction. So you all should use it. That's it. It's a short paper. It's one of the easier way of getting published, getting your paper published. Mm-hmm. But of course you have to collect all the data, which is not easy. Yeah. But the writing itself is easier than a research article.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And remind me, the others on the paper with you, that's your advisors?
No, I mean, I'm working, I mean, they are my advisor, but they're not on the offer list. Maybe that would change, I don't know, but yeah, this thing is pretty independent. So I'm working with Ted, and in terms of doing the topic model stuff, the text analysis stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like checking closely, like if the interpretation makes sense and all that. Yeah, so not co-authoring with my advisors yet. Maybe in the future we will, but let's just see how the data set looks like, because I only have data for one region, so still mm-hmm. work to be done. Yeah.
Awesome. You said you have results that came out just recently.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is very interesting. So yeah, obviously you can see this in the podcast, but yeah, it looks like a plot. The plot basically shows each party in different years how likely they are to bring up a topic. Now you can see that they are just all over the place. It's like a scatter plot that makes sense, because obviously you do not want to focus solely on just one topic. Mm-hmm. That cannot get you elected. And probably that's not the reason that why you're elected, because we're looking after elections here. Mm-hmm. These are legislative records. And also one reason that why it's scattered like that is that you will also be involved in a lot of different things in the legislature, not just like one issue. So for example, the CU, the Convergence and Union Party, the government party for a long time, you see there's not a lot of variation in terms of the likelihood of bringing up a topic. But that's because they're a government party, they have to deal with a lot of things at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. So it sort of gives you a rough idea of how likely they are to talk about a topic compared to other topics, but you can also compare like how likely I'm going to talk about the same topic compared to another party. So for example, the CEU compared to the ERC. You can also do that. Yeah. A few things. The cool thing about this approach is that you have uncertainty. So you see those error bars?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah? So that's an uncertainty estimate. It is the 95% confidence interval. So usually if you do expert survey, for example, you're asking a bunch of experts, you have the uncertainty estimate. But the error bar could be much higher because you don't have that many N. Mm. Here, you basically have an N of in the thousands because you're looking at a lot of different documents. Mm-hmm. That's why the error bar, when you have enough documents, they're short. These long ones, the reason they are so uncertain because they don't have enough documents. So for example, this is 2020. Of course, you don't have enough data for 2020. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that is very cool. You have an uncertainty estimation. A lot of the times when you're dealing with left-right placement, you're asking the experts, okay, where does this party fall in terms of the left-right scale? Well, you don't have a lot of variations, which may not be true in the real world. So this is very interesting, very cool. Yeah.
Nice. And would we be able to share this with our listeners?
The plot?
Yes.
Sure, it's just very rough, but sure.
Perfect. Well, just so everyone has an idea of what we've been talking about,
yeah.
We will put that in the additional information.
And one more thing, the cool thing about the structural topic models is mm-hmm. that you can do word clouds. So see, it could show what words are more common in the same topic. So for example, this is citizenship. So citizenship is huge. And the second most important word is dependents, and then family and other stuff. So it's a very neat way of visualizing what a topic really is. Mm-hmm. So that's a cool thing about the structural topic model or the STM package. This is done with the STM package in R, by the way, for those who are inclined with the technicalities.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you favor R? Generally?
I use both R and Python. The reason is that I use R for statistical stuff, mm-hmm. but for web scraping, I use Python. Mm-hmm. It could be that there are also other packages that exist in R for web scraping that I'm not aware of, mm-hmm. but I know how to do the stuff in Python. If you have a website, you want to get like links and stuff, you just use Beautiful Soup for, you parse the whole thing, and then it will give you all the links. For example, I need to download like 9,000 documents. That's very helpful mm-hmm. because it would spit out the 9,000 links for me. And then I just use something else to get the documents. Mm-hmm. That's super easy in Python. I think you can do the same thing in R, it's just that I'm not aware of that. But yeah. And also in general, the advantage of knowing both languages is that Python for a long time is the language to use if you're going into machine learning. So scikit-learn, Keras, if you're interested in deep learning, those packages, they're very well written and easy to use. R is catching up, but still, if you are working in the business world or in the social science, if you want to do something about machine learning or deep learning, Python is still the norm. So that's the advantage of knowing both. And by the way, they're not that different. And in Oldham, we also offer open lab for both R and Python.
Yes.
So if you know one, you can probably take the class in the other language, and then you'll see they're not that different. It's this, it's pretty much the same idea, except that there's a small difference in terms of like how you call things, how you manipulate objects. That's like the small difference there. Yeah.
Nice, that's great. And for everyone listening, as Kyle just mentioned, there are R Open Labs and Python Open Labs, co-sponsored and hosted by the Odum Institute and the Davis Library Research Hub and the University Libraries. So we'll put those links down below for anyone who's interested.
Yes. Add time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get some sponsorships.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. So you also mentioned the second part of this project was focused a lot on feelings about immigration and how much it's talked about. Yes, I'd just like to talk about that a little bit, how you've approached it.
Okay, so once you have the estimates from the first stage, you sort of know how likely a party is to talk positively about immigration and how likely they are talk negatively about immigration. So that's good. The next thing is to figure out why they talk about that positively or negatively on average. Then it's just like your average social science paper, right? You just fit a regression model with a bunch of covariates to predict those different dependent variables coming from the first stage. I need to rework my theory a little bit, so I'm meeting my advisor tomorrow, but the idea generally is that you can use a bunch of other covariates, such as like regional authority. At time again, we have a data set on that, called the Regional Authority Index in the Department of Political Science. I'm also working as an RA on that project, so we're measuring how much authority a regional government has. And it's a pretty neat data set, and we're updating that. So you can also use that, for example, as a covariate. And then you have a bunch of other party level or regional level covariates, such as like how many people are coming in, going out, you know, in migration rate, out migration rate. You can also use those stuff to see what really explains the focus on positive aspects or the negative aspects of immigration. Yeah. After all, the whole reason of doing all this is that there are some regionalist parties that are very positive about immigration. Some of them not so much. And the reason is to, the motivation is to figure out why. So that sort of comes back full circle, and we try to answer that research question in the first place. Yeah.
I think you also mentioned that what's interesting about this particular piece is that the rate of immigration or the percentage of immigrants in the countries that you're looking at in regions stays fairly static, but
that's in terms of like the proportion, yes. In terms of composition, the in and out migration rate, no. So that thing changes every year, and if you're interested, you can go to Eurostat, which is the statistical archive for European countries, and you can check the data. It changes all the time. Sometimes you have more people coming in, you have more people going out, but it could, at other times, it could be the other way around. You have more people, you have less people coming in. Yeah, so that thing changes, but the composition though. So like compare, like in the entire population, how many percentages of the population have some sort of immigrant background. That thing barely changes. Because you're not gonna get, for example, from 2019, 5% to this year, 100%. No, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So that thing is fairly static, and that creates a problem for explaining party positions on immigration, because we know that parties can flip their position overnight. And if your explanation, if your independent variable barely changes, there's not enough variance to explain the changes in the dependent variable. So that creates a problem, and that's why we're doing this estimation thing, trying to figure out the yearly values for the party positions. And then once we incorporate that with yearly data for our independent variables, then everything is on the same scale, then it's easy to measure. And I mean, it's easy to do the regression. Yeah.
Great. And again, I just want to go back to what the broader value of this, a big part of what we're trying to do with this podcast is just show people how diverse social sciences are and why they are necessary.
Mm-hmm. I mean, aside from the nerdy aspects of this, is that you know where parties stand and you sort of know how they compete for votes. So this could be useful for figuring out party strategies. You can figure out, you can see, like, for example, why a party moved from talking about only the economy to suddenly talking about immigration. You can see that in the data. Mm-hmm. Before, it may be very difficult because we don't have yearly estimates. We only have election year estimates.
Yeah.
That makes sense, right? Because party releases a manifesto every 4 years. Mm-hmm. Every 4 years is way too long. I mean, comparing, I mean, even with the U.S. case, the political climate in 2012 is very different from the political climate in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have yearly estimates like that, you can't do a lot of analyses. So I think that's the major added value here, is that you have a yearly estimate of party positions, which is very difficult to get if you're only looking at manifestos.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that I can do that is that I'm looking at legislative records. So that covers also off-election periods. So when there's no election, then maybe the topics that you talk about would be different from the election years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also another way of using this data. Yeah.
What got you into, have you always been into political science?
And yes and no. So the no part is that I think for a lot of us, folks in social science, you are pressured to get to do something like to do some degree that could land you into a real job. You know, parents, they always put pressure on you on this one. So yeah, I was pressured into doing either accountancy or something else that is not social science. And yeah, it was a hard time trying to explain to my parents like why I wanted to do political science and where that could bring me to. Yeah, by the way, I'm also a first-gen college student and also first-gen grad student. So you need to explain a lot, like getting into college, why doing this major could lead you to a better career. And it's not easy with the many social sciences. So yeah, I was choosing between accountancy and social science, political science in general. I interview at the accountancy program. Oh, by the way, context. In the U.S., you choose your major after you're in. In Hong Kong and many other places, you do that before. So that's why the following happens. So I need to choose on my application whether I would state that I want to join the business school or the School of Social Science. So in the beginning, it was still business first. I mean, the family pressure, and also it seems a good way to go about it. I mean, accountancy, it's a good profession, and it could bring you a pretty good career. The issue is that you really have to deal with the same software or the same, I mean, you have to look at ledgers and all that stuff, like for the next 30, 40 years. It's just painful. Yeah. And also at that time, it was 2012 when I was entering the college. It's also when a lot of protests are happening in Hong Kong. And I just see that aside from just getting a good job, like there's something else that you could do in life, right? Like, for example, thinking about how we can arrive at better governance, thinking about how to get to democracy. I mean, that's what political science is about generally. So that's what I got interested. That's why I got interested in political science as well, and I was choosing between the two. At the end of the day, I decided that I could not stand looking at ledgers for the next 40 years. So yeah, I picked political science as my first choice, and then I got in and been studying that for like almost forever. And then I'm now doing a PhD. Yeah.
Yeah. Has your family come around to the social sciences?
You mean
were you able to convince them?
Oh yeah. Well, yes and no. Yes and no. The yes part is that they sort of see. Yeah. I mean, I convinced them with results. Mm-hmm. I did. Very luckily, I got supported by a scholarship, so money is not an issue. Mm. So yeah, that sort of sorted that out. But do they really want me to do this? I still think that as of today, no. Mm-hmm. But I think it just takes time to show them what career that could bring me to. I mean, by the way, a lot of the times, political science PhDs, being a professor is not the only way out mm-hmm. for a career. A lot of us actually become data scientists. So yeah, that could also be an alternative way of convincing them, like, you know, it's not only becoming a professor or becoming a faculty. Mm-hmm. Can also get a real job, if you will, in the data sciences, which is booming nowadays. Maybe not in the next 5 years. I don't know. Nobody knows. But yeah, that's what it is as of today.
Nice.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So did your undergrad in Hong Kong, and then mm-hmm. you did your master's in the Netherlands.
Yes.
Yes. What brought you to North Carolina?
Right. So I got accepted to several programs, and I chose UNC because of my advisors. My advisors, Lisbeth Holger and Gary Marks, they are very prominent scholars in political science, especially in the European politics subfield. So that was not a very difficult choice to make. It's just the advisor factor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know much about North Carolina in general. I mean, I did spend some time in New York City. That was about it. That's like my only experience with the US. And that's very different from the real US, which mm-hmm. here in North Carolina sort of gives me that impression. So yeah, I didn't know much about it until I'm here. So I think, I mean, I like it. Weather is nice, people are very friendly. It's just very different compared to New York City, but I wouldn't say which one is better because New Yorkers are very proud with their city. But yeah, I think that here is just that the atmosphere is also very good for international folks. As long as you stay within major cities, by the way, because if you get out to the rural areas, then there's another story, but.
Yeah. You mentioned that there's a big difference between how Europe handles graduate education, how the U.S. does it. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes. So the U.S. PhD programs, structured, very systematic. So a lot of people do at least 5 years. The reason that it is so long is that you are also getting an MA on the way. So for your first 2 years, you do coursework like any master's students would. Mm-hmm. Once you've done that, you have an MA thesis, you defend, there you go, you're now an MA. And then for the next 3 years, you start writing on your dissertation, and then after that, you get your PhD. People usually take longer than 5 years, but that's the idea. Mm-hmm. You get your MA and your PhD at the same time. It's a package deal. In Europe, the programs are shorter. The reason being that they do the master's separately from the PhD. So a lot of the programs, they will require you to have a master's degree before applying. Mm. So the first 2 years are separated from the next 3 years. So that's why a lot of the European PhDs are either 3 or 4 years long.
Okay.
So they're shorter. And they're less structured. So I had this interesting experience when I got accepted into Cambridge. So I was in a Skype call with my potential advisor, and his first question was like, okay, so what are you going to do here? Why you here, right? For the next 3 years, what courses do you want to take? What do you want to do? I was like, well, I thought that there is something to follow. Seems not. Okay, that's cool, but also I'm not so sure about this. Anyway, yeah, so you actually have a lot of flexibility in terms of what course you want to take and what you want to do while you're there. So that's the UK approach. The European approach, so anything but the UK, because the UK is special anyway. The European approach is that you are actually applying something like a job. So usually schools, they got some money, they got some funding, and then they open up a PhD position. There's a certain project already attached to the PhD. So I, for example, I know somebody who's doing a PhD in geography in Switzerland. So his project has like a predefined theme. So he's going to work on urban planning, for example. He cannot change that theme. His dissertation thesis must sort of focus on that theme. You cannot change that. So that's where we're different from us, because you can figure out what you're going to do in your first 2 years and then you decide. But in a lot of the European PhD programs, that's predetermined. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and just to wrap up.
Okay, sure.
I want to talk about a little bit, how did you come to Odum?
Yeah, so the Odum folks are very nice. So they actually went to our orientation meeting when I first joined the department. And she was talking about the courses offered here. So aside from the open lab, there are also other stuff like STATA and all that. So yeah, I know that Odum is a good resource from the beginning. And then later I participated in the Tom Carsey Graduate Student Symposium. And then I got myself in, on the mailing list. And then I sort of applied for the stats help desk job and I got it. So that's very nice. And now I'm part of the team. So yeah, that's how I got involved. Yeah. But I must say this, like the reason that I know of Odum is mainly for the resources part. And I think a lot of the programs, this isn't made very obvious. This is not very obvious to most people. A lot of the folks didn't even know that the Odum exists, which is bad. But yeah, it's a good resource, and I think people could, once they know the resource, if they use it, then it will be very helpful for their own research too.
I agree. Let's see. I think we're about done. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to cover?
No, up to you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Kyle, for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Definitely. And yeah. Thank you for joining us, listeners. Tune in next time to Data Night.
All right. Bye.